From the KGOU studios, I'm Rebecca Cruz, filling in for Suzette Gerlot, who's in Chile this week. And welcome to Worldviews. Joshua Landis joins me to remember the late UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali.
He liked a number of my articles and wrote me very nice and kind notes. And he was an extraordinary man, and he really symbolized the period that he grew up in.
Then we'll hear from Northwestern University social anthropologist Adia Benton. Her research in Sierra Leone focuses on what she calls HIV exceptionalism.
It's a disease like no other, requiring often separate funding streams, separate personnel, and other things that would segregate it from other forms of care.
How HIV/AIDS affects development and cultural and political institutions in Africa. But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and welcome back to the roundtable, Joshua Landis. This week, we heard about the passing of former UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali, and it turns out that you not only know quite a bit about him, but that you actually corresponded with him, which over Facebook, as I understand it. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about that? I love that it's over Facebook, because that's just, a sign of the times that we are connecting with people over social media.
Well, yes, indeed. Boutros Boutros-Ghali, who was the head of the UN.
An Egyptian, so from the Middle East.
An Egyptian. He's a Coptic Egyptian, so a Christian Egyptian. I had a wonderful time exchanging notes with him on Facebook, because I wrote Syria comment, and he was and was commenting on the Arab Spring and so forth, which he was deeply interested in. And he liked a number of my articles and wrote me very nice and kind notes. And we exchanged views. And at any rate, he was an extraordinary man, and he really symbolized his age, the period that he grew up in, which is a Nasserist period. And Gamal Abdel Nasser was a very controversial character, of course, in the West, because he stood for Arab nationalism after World War II, when the Third World was growing independent, trying the non-alignment movement, and socialism. And even though he was a Christian, came from a fairly upper-class family, law school, so forth, he supported Nasser. And this drew him into foreign affairs, the Suez Crisis, a number of other land reform. He believed that the Third World had to pick itself up by its bootstraps. He wrote about development intensively. But he also believed in the more controversial things, like nationalization of the Suez Canal and so forth. And this led him into constant controversy with the United States, mm-hmm. particularly once he became – after 92, when he became head of the UN.
Which was a very difficult time in the world. We have the end of the Cold War, of course. We have then Rwanda, Somalia, the Balkans breaking up. A difficult time to be leading the United Nations.
He got a lot of flack. You know, people blamed him mm-hmm. for Rwanda and other stuff. But also America turned against him a bit, because this was America's age. Once the Soviet Union collapsed and Tiananmen Square had been right there in 1990 or 89. And so China was on its heels. Russia was completely falling apart, and America was the world power and began to treat people a little high-handedly. The Third World, which was suffering from the debt crisis, wanted debt forgiveness, and Boutros Boutros-Ghali championed the Third World.
Because he came from, well, the first African.
He's an African and he's a Middle Easterner, and he said, you've got to do debt forgiveness. We have to have investment, Marshall Plan for the Third World. All of this went unheeded. And he described a meeting with Madeleine Albright, who was the head of the UN, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, and the American foreign secretary at the time, in which he said, you've got to let me criticize America from time to time at a luncheon. And they both looked at him with daggers in his eyes. And he said – he described it later. He said, when I said this, they both looked at me as if the fish dinner I had just served them stunk and was rotten. And he had bad relations with the United States, because he was constantly pushing for a better deal for the Third World. And also because Rwanda, Somalia, there were a bunch of Yugoslavia, mm-hmm. things that went desperately wrong. And the United States was taking it out on the UN and began to stop paying its money to mm-hmm. the UN and so forth. So there was constant rancor.
And they actually – the United States blocked his his position from continuing
right.
to have
he
another.
He supported Kofi Annan, right. another African who got the job instead of him.
And was more friendly, if you will, to the United States, or at least the anticipation was that he would be.
Indeed. But, you know, throughout his life, a long life, he championed the Third World and a better deal for the poor.
Well, very sad news, certainly, for him and his family, and gives us an opportunity to look back at some of the foreign diplomatic history here. So thank you for sharing your personal recollections with him, your Facebook comments with him. What an interesting conversation those must have been. And thank you for joining us, Joshua.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation or answer any questions you might have. You can leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org. You can send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU and find us on KGOU's Facebook page. You can also download all of our past shows and subscribe to our podcast to have full episodes and segments delivered to your desktop, tablet, or mobile device. After a short break, we'll hear Suzette Grelot's conversation about HIV and AIDS in Africa with social anthropologist Adia Benton. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz. Our guest this half hour is Adia Benton. She's a social anthropologist at Northwestern University who studies political economy and global health. She's the author of the 2015 book, HIV Exceptionalism, Development Through Disease in Sierra Leone. She spoke with our regular host, Suzette Grelot.
Adia Benton, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you've written a book about Sierra Leone entitled HIV Exceptionalism. I just have to start right off the bat with the obvious question. What do you mean by that, HIV exceptionalism?
Well, HIV exceptionalism is a phrase or term that was coined by early critics of a model which saw HIV as an exceptional disease requiring an exceptional response. And what does that mean? It means it's a disease like no other, requiring often separate funding streams, separate personnel, and other things that make it that would segregate it from other forms of care. And so that's basically the root of what I'm talking about in the book.
So when you say it segregates that disease from others because it is, as you suggest, exceptional, that means that it distracts us from other health concerns? Or is, I mean, I guess I'm trying to understand the kind of the negative. Are you using this in a negative way in the sense that it's somehow distracting us from other diseases that are just as important, or that all concerns in this country are health concerns are concerns and we need to focus on all of them?
So I'm using it as a normative statement in the sense that it's the way HIV programs are generally run in this era. So there was a point at which HIV did not receive a lot of separate funding. There was a point at which there weren't people who were specially trained to address the medical, clinical, social, and economic considerations that are associated with an HIV diagnosis. But as a group of activists, clinicians, and public health advocates really pushed for extra money and extra separate personnel and an attention to some of the issues that HIV brings to light, such as stigma or really unique kinds of clinical manifestations of the disease, that's when these new kinds of institutions, funding streams, personnel kind of came about. So it's a description of a situation about how people are addressing HIV/AIDS. And you can't really talk about HIV/AIDS without also talking about something like tuberculosis or other kinds of infections that come in if a person is immunocompromised by HIV. So there's that. But one thing that we learned from our experiences in the 80s in the U.S., for example, HIV also carried with it lots of stigma because it was associated with certain kinds of sexual orientations and certain kinds of sexual practices. And so I think people were quite right to think of HIV as exceptional at the time. But as the condition became more manageable for people who had access to drugs, as there were more social services dedicated to people who were disabled or were unable to work as a result of their condition, it became less exceptional and more amenable to being streamlined into other things. And so what we found was, or what we see in the 2000s, what they call the post-treatment era, was that those concerns of the 80s were carried over into programming elsewhere, which is to say addressing stigma, addressing, say, economic inequality for women, addressing clinical care or the lack of labs or whatever became part of the HIV programming. So I'm not sure if that wraps it up, which is to say it's...
Well, you've said a lot there that in the sense that I want to come back to some of the things that you said mm-hmm. When you talked about healthcare advocates and mm-hmm. healthcare workers. Definitely want to come back to that issue. But, I mean, what I'm hearing you say is that this disease, HIV, AIDS, is obviously connected to a number of other diseases on the one hand, but also another slate of issues and concerns, like you mentioned, inequality. And you've written about how health crises have an impact on other institutions within society, socioeconomic and other, I would imagine, political institutions. So can you kind of draw some greater connections? I mean, you just kind of, you know, mentioned them, but in what way are all of these things connected in terms of the diseases themselves having a greater impact on society and its institutions? It's a big question.
That's a big question. So, earlier work on HIV. So when I'm talking about earlier work, I mean the 90s. We as anthropologists, but also people who are political scientists and economists, turned away from trying to change behavior and to looking at concerns of, okay, so why are women at a greater disadvantage or more at risk for HIV? They would say, oh, well, it's clearly about women's unequal positions. Well, how are they unequally positioned in relation to men? Well, they're not always able to negotiate condom use. And why might that be? And so a lot of the stories became, well, this is about understanding gender equality or trying to strive for that. It's about striving for economic equality between men and women. And so these got pulled into HIV programs because I think health advocates and justice advocates were right, but also, I won't say distracted, but were good at drawing the larger connections between disease risk and inequality and justice concerns.
So access to the law, access to education,
absolutely,
access to social services, access to any kind of support. Obviously, that kind of inequality is,
right,
is what you're talking about. And then therefore has an impact on the disease,
right,
and its impact on particular individuals. So
right,
the relationship is a two-way street,
yes,
in this regard.
Right. Yes. So the disease risk is shaped by social, political, the economic things, and a person's ability to address the disease itself are also affected by their ability to access healthcare, to access education, et cetera.
That's Adia Benton, an anthropologist at Northwestern University who studies the political, economic, and global health responses to HIV and AIDS in Africa. We'll hear more of this conversation right after this break. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I'm sitting in today for Suzette Grelot, who's leading an OU Alumni Association trip through South America. We're hearing her conversation today with Adia Benton. They've been talking about her work studying the political and economic factors that go into global health response to HIV and AIDS in Africa.
And to add to the mix here, I mean, you're obviously studying a post-conflict area. So I have to ask you kind of why Sierra Leone? Why have you spent so much time there? Why a book about Sierra Leone on this subject? Because there are, I would imagine, a number of other places that you could also study. And so kind of coming at it from that perspective, the post-conflict development perspective and the healthcare crises that come are magnified, I guess, by that. You know, how is Sierra Leone set apart, or is it? Or is it similar to, you know, other post-conflict areas and the impact of this disease and other diseases on their development?
So I got to Sierra Leone a little bit by accident. When I was applying to my PhD program, I happened to be working there on a conflict issue on Liberian refugee women who were experiencing or addressing the issue of sexual violence, war-related and otherwise. And so as I was there, I started to see a lot of sort of post-conflict rebuilding and reconstruction efforts that were built around health were looking at certain kinds of diseases, and HIV was one of them. And the conventional wisdom at the time was that conflict-affected places would have higher HIV prevalence. And this looked to be – seemed to be true for places like Mozambique or Angola, but it wasn't – it didn't – no one knew if this was true for other settings. And in fact, in the middle of my research, it was proven that the link is not a direct one or an obvious one, right? So some places actually had lower HIV prevalence than one would expect based upon regional figures, and some had higher. And so the question then becomes, is it conflict itself or some other kinds of dynamics within conflict-affected societies that shapes HIV risk? And the answer, no one really knows. But even after that knowledge, that information was circulated, the idea in Sierra Leone was that you still had to – there must be HIV. And so a lot of the earlier programming in the post-conflict moment focused on how do we prevent this greater spread, or how do we address all of the people who must have it. And what ended up happening was when they did the seroprevalence survey, which is a survey to find out how much HIV is in a population, they discovered that it was actually substantially lower than they had predicted on the basis of modeling, statistical modeling. So my concern then was, okay, so now what do we do? How do policymakers, how do officials in the health system, how do they manage this new knowledge? And does it affect how they address the issue of HIV?
And the answer is?
The answer is.
It sounds to me like you have an answer here.
I hope I do. I guess the answer is that it's hard to backtrack when you've made the case that HIV is significant, because it has a kind of moral weight as an infection or as a disease. It's hard to backtrack because lots of funding depends on – financing of healthcare depends on HIV being a significant problem. In fact, that's one of the most heavily funded diseases probably in the history of diseases. So it's a hard sell. And in fact, it was an object of conflict because even when those numbers were low, folks wanted to believe that they were high.
It justified their work there.
It justified their work, but it also justified what was conventional knowledge or was conventional wisdom at the time, which is that war changes everything.
So these perspectives, and I think this gets back to this relationship with NGO workers and healthcare advocates and others that are more or less coming into the area to address a lot of this. And you mentioned the funding and all of that. I mean, we know that non-governmental organizations are busily at work across the continent of Africa, and they bring with them a significant amount of funding from various agencies. And so you're right. I mean, they kind of have to interpret the data in some ways to help support their work. But can you tell us kind of from your perspective how effective these workers are, how effective these organizations are in terms of coming into the region and trying to manage these problems and perhaps bringing with them these skewed perspectives?
So I should add that some of the conflict came from local activists and local health officials, which was very interesting. In fact, the CDC numbers were the ones that showed the lower prevalence. And so I had, and I write about this in the book, a Ministry of Health official who works in the statistics office, he said, well, we actually have to do another survey because we aren't sure that the CDC did it right.
And so what is their motivation? If the local healthcare workers, again, is it tied to resources?
I'm sure. Well, to some extent, I think it's tied to resources, but it's also tied to, again, the conventional wisdom about, okay. Right?
So it's not being able to get away from that
right,
mindset.
Which is, I think, it's a really hard thing to believe. We're talking about high rates of sexual violence. We're talking about troops that came in from other high prevalence countries who were very much involved in the sex trade and they have sex with local women and men. And so it is not out of – it doesn't sound preposterous for there to have been some sort of higher prevalence. And so I think the first bit was trying to reckon with that disparity that they saw. But the truth is HIV care money can buttress other things. It can strengthen other systems. And I'm not sure that that was ever going to be the case in Sierra Leone because of how narrowly funneled the money was, but they do the amount of money being brought into the country by HIV work was definitely it had the potential to develop people who were more skilled in monitoring and evaluation work or doing research on HIV-related stuff. It had the potential to make labs better. It had the potential to build counseling services. It had the potential to do a whole bunch of other things. Now, my concern was that it didn't do all of that, right? And so the people who were working on HIV only worked on HIV. And some of them got bored because there aren't a lot of cases, but also because the same problems would come up again and again. Oh, the PCR machine isn't working.
So the day-to-day work versus the ultimate problem. Okay, so just very quickly, in the last 30 seconds we have, what is it that we really need to know about this issue? Because I think a lot of us feel kind of helpless and hopeless about these particular health crises in the region.
So I would say that we should think about better attention to building health systems. So rather than focusing on specific disease and specific conditions, we need to think about what it means to build health systems, what it means to build robust health systems that's properly staffed, that have systems that have the appropriate infrastructure, systems that are capable of reaching the most vulnerable. And that's something that's very difficult to do. We don't even have it here. So,
well, therein lies the challenge. All right. Thank you so much, Adia. Thank you for being with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Suzette Gerlot's conversation with anthropologist Adia Benton. You can find more information about her book, HIV Exceptionalism, Development Through Disease in Sierra Leone, on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews as part of a partnership with the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Brian Hardzinski prepares our web content and edits the interviews, and Sam Dupre puts the show together. For Joshua Landis and Suzette Gerlot, I'm Rebecca Cruz.